Hi, everybody. Today is Thursday, October 16, 2025. And Alex Cranier, our friend, is here with us. Welcome back, Alex.
Thank you for having me, Nima. Always good to join you.
Alex, a lot to talk about today. Iran, Russia, China. But before going there, we had a summit in Egypt, in Sharm el-Sheikh. And Arab countries, European countries all participated. Donald Trump, you know, showed that it was a huge victory for the peace and all of that. But you see Donald Trump making new rhetorics. I feel the same way. I was feeling the same way when it came to Russia. And right now he's putting himself in a corner, in a position that there is no exit in that position. And that position is defining, disarming Hamas, you know, demilitarizing Gaza without addressing the reality and the root causes of the problem in Gaza, which is the occupation, which is the settlers. You know, at the same time, Netanyahu and Smotrich was talking about they will establish settlement in Gaza. And that would bring security. How can you argue that you're going to disarm Hamas? And Donald Trump said that the United States is going to do that. Here is what he said, Alex.
Told them we want disarm, and they will disarm. And if they don't disarm, we will disarm them. And it'll happen quickly and perhaps violently. But they will disarm. Do you understand me?
Yes.
Because quickly. Everyone says, oh, well, they won't disarm. They will disarm. And I spoke to Hamas, and I said, you're going to disarm, right? Yes, sir, we're going to disarm. That's what they told me. They will disarm, or we will disarm them. Got it? Okay.
What next. Is the deadline?
I cannot believe that without putting conditions out there, Hamas would decide about it, would disarm. You're taking that, Alex.
Well, the day before, I think he said something exactly the opposite. You know, he was on the flight, on the plane, and the journalists were asking him about disarming Hamas. And he was saying, well, you know, they are in, you know, they have to maintain order there. So for the time being, they're going to be, you know, in charge, and they have to remain armed because they need to maintain order in the Gaza Strip. It seems to me that Trump treats all this situation as a very transitory thing. I struggle to explain it to myself, but it seems to me that Trump has been formed, you know, as a public persona through American show business, you know, where you say something at a given moment that will please whatever audience you think you're addressing. And then it doesn't really matter because everybody's attention spans are extremely short. So whatever I say today to this public, you know, we move on and then I'm going to say something else to the next public. And so that makes it extremely difficult to read Trump, what his real intentions are. But let's say that in the case of this peace deal, last time you and I spoke, I was deeply pessimistic about it. I was wondering, why is he bothering even? This is never going to hold. I think he's just buying time to avoid going to war against Iran. That was my idea. Now it seems to me that he did manage to get a very significant buy-in for practically all the parties involved. Iran is not there. The Russians are not there, but all the Arab countries are there, and they seem to be extremely serious about this peace. Hamas has committed to it. Even the Israeli cabinet has committed to it. And so whatever he just said in that video clip that you showed, I don't know if that needs to be taken seriously. Because also, if I think about how are you going to disarm Hamas? Exactly how are you going to do that? I don't see the way, you know, because Israel has been trying to do this for more than 2 years and they haven't succeeded. What is Trump going to do? Is he going to send U.S. troops? And what are the American troops going to do that the Israeli troops were not able to do? How are they going to do it? So it seems to me that Trump is just signaling what he wants to signal at this time to this audience. And there's no intention behind it. There's no commitment to it because he counts with people's short attention span. 1 week later, nobody's going to remember any of this. And we're going to be dealing with the next thing. So I can't take this seriously. And I've already, you know, I've been trying already for months not to even pay attention to things that Trump says, to try instead to pay attention to what his administration does and what effects seem to be gathering on the ground.
You wrote a piece, which I shared it on X, about the British, how British would influence the case of the peace in the Middle East and how the game of the Brits there. What's your point? And I think many people should know about it. We have audience here who have never maybe heard about your piece or didn't read it. What is the main point that you're making, which I found it so valid and important?
Well, I, for a very long time now, I've been kind of finding the hand of the British establishment in every crisis theater everywhere around the world. They're always there, and they're there in a very quiet and discreet way. You don't find British military. You don't find necessarily many known British government officials, but you do find a lot of these intelligence assets, NGOs, charities, the British Council, private companies, and so forth. And they're always there. And it seems to me that Trump took them by surprise with this peace deal. That they didn't see it coming. They didn't expect it, and it caught them off guard. Because let's go back 100 years. The British Empire created the Zionist project. And then they moved a lot of pieces into place. It was a very long-term complex game to create the State of Israel, and they did it. They created the State of Israel, and they created it for a reason. And that reason wasn't to provide a homeland for the long-suffering Jewish people. It was a cynical play for the ends of the British Empire. And the, you know, alumni of the round, Alfred Milner's round table articulated what the reason was. They said basically, if Britain is going to remain as a maritime empire, it needs to seed this region with a particularly patriotic stock. And they weren't able to do this with the Arabs. So they decided to bring Jews there, and then to create the Jewish State of Israel. And the whole objective of the Jewish State of Israel there was to keep the whole region destabilized, perpetually at war, because it's a strategically important region. And rather than attempting to control it militarily, which you couldn't even theoretically, nobody has that many troops and police, you just keep the region in a state of chaos perpetually, because that makes it easier to play one tribe, one country, one, you know, region against the other, while you secretly deal with everybody. It's the typical balance of powers, British geopolitics. Now, you're involved, everybody knows you're involved, and now you have to explain, why is this reason perpetually at war? And then the narrative is always like, oh, it's so complicated, you know, centuries of hatreds, very primitive, irrational people. You can't negotiate with them. They're always at each other's throats. And like, what can we do? You know, it's just like that, you know, and we're trying to do our best, but you see, these people are beyond hope. And then Trump comes in, and after 10 months of his presidency, he gets everybody to the around the table, and he gets them to sign a peace agreement. And so now this is a big blow for British diplomacy, because what is so complicated about peace that they could not figure out, that Trump did figure out? You know, Trump, the guy that everybody loves to hate, he figured it out. So the day after Trump announced the peace on the 10th October, what was the Sunday? Sunday was the 12th, right? Yeah, 2 days after. British Secretary of Education comes on Sky News for an interview, and she says, we shaped this peace behind the scenes because it's the right thing to do and it's in our interest and blah, 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 blah. And then the interviewer asked her, like, okay, so you did all this stuff behind the scenes, like what? And then she couldn't explain. She couldn't, then she sounds like a high school student who's doing a book report about a book that they never read. You know, he's just like, oh, you know, well, it's very complicated. And, but, you know, good on the Americans that they contributed to. So they're trying to take credit because it's massively embarrassing. It puts them in a very, under very bad light. And then, you know, Trump even had them all fly to to Egypt, where, you know, he put them through another very light, very subtle humiliation ritual, especially Keir Starmer, to make it very obvious who did make the peace happen and who is just a bystander and observer. And so I think that the British Education Secretary, Bridget, I forget her last name now, she probably caused a lot more damage by trying to claim credit for this piece than had she said nothing. Because by disingenuously claiming credit, she only drew attention to the fact that they didn't contribute anything. In fact, for decades, they've been dissimulating how, you know, it's just impossible to make peace here because, you know, all these people that are, you know, so irrational, so primitive, so violent, and the issues are so incredibly complicated that, you know, even we sophisticated people with our posh accent can't possibly do anything about it.
Yeah. Bridget Phillipson.
Yeah. Bridget Phillipson. Yeah. There you go. Thank you.
Yeah. Alex, I think when it comes, I don't know if you've read that Iran is just changing its behavior, because before, you know, Iran has been under sanctions for many years and they know how to deal with the sanctions when it comes to the exportation of the oil and gas and all of this. But recently they have decided to, you know, to behave differently. What does that mean? The tankers that which they used to use, you know, other countries' flags, today they're using Iranian flags. And it was so strange for many people. Why is Iran doing this? And from what I've heard from the Iranian media, because Iran is sending a sign, if you want to fight Iran, if you attack the tankers, we're ready to respond. You know, I don't know why did it happen and how did it happen in Iran? Because for many years, many people were arguing, why are we so afraid that we have to use other countries' flag? And there was a lot of arguments in Iran, and because of this, because of that, political, geopolitical, and all of these reasons. But Iran has changed. And I see something happening. It's not just about Iran, Alex. It's about Russia. It's about China. Something different is happening. They don't want to, you know, bend. They don't want to, you know, chicken out. This is a new attitude. Why is that happening? In the case of Iran, what is your understanding of this decision? This sort of, when I follow the Iranian media, I'm so shocked with these new changes that are happening in the decision, in the mind of the decision makers in Iran.
Of course, I don't know exactly, but my guess would be that they're feeling increasingly confident that they're on the right side of history and that they're on the winning side. And I think that this is the consequence of the fact, which is increasingly obvious, that the Western Empire has sustained a strategic defeat in the Middle East, in Western Asia. And that I think that this was apparent at the very least since June this year, since the 12-day war. And America's inability to defeat Houthis in Yemen. So I think that the peace that was just signed between Israel and Hamas actually makes that undeniable. It cements it, because I really see this piece as Trump basically cemented Israel's defeat. Some might say that he's protecting them from themselves, maybe, but it's becoming undeniable now. And in a way, you could even argue that he handed a victory to Hamas, because, you know, Hamas already won, but now it's in black and white. And so I think that the Western Empire sustained a strategic defeat. And now, if you sail your tankers under your own flag, and they get attacked or they get confiscated, as you know the British and the Americans have done in the past, well, then there's no question about whose property you're stealing. And it puts the cards down on the table. So it's almost like daring them. Here it is. It's almost a glove thrown in their faces. These are our ships carrying our oil exports. I dare you to do something about it. That would be my guess, Nima. I'm not sure that I'm 100% certain, but they didn't make this change to amuse themselves. It's not for fun. There's a strategic reason for it, and it's not for the lack of confidence. It's for a greater confidence that they feel in with regards to their Western adversaries.
Because it's not just about Iran. I think they have decided, together with Russia, maybe China knows about it. And because Russia is experiencing the same sort of sanctions, so they have to, you know, they have to decide how to deal with this issue after all. And yesterday, many, many, you know, comments about the situation in Ukraine. Donald Trump himself, you have Scott Bessent talking about it. But still, when you look at the situation, the way that Donald Trump is picturing the situation in Ukraine, you see a lot of rhetoric. And if you change the head of Donald Trump himself, the physique of Donald Trump, and put it Joe Biden there, Alex, it seems to me that Joe Biden is talking to us. Here is what Donald Trump said yesterday.
War that should have beaten, he should have won that war in 1 week. He's now going to soon be into his fourth year. He's lost 1.5 million soldiers, probably close. Certainly in terms of wounded and no legs and no arms and all the things that happen in horrible wars. It's a horrible war. That's the biggest thing that's happened since World War II in terms of death. It's bigger than any of them. I settled 8 of them. The biggest is that in terms of death. incredible. I think India, Pakistan had great potential too. We did a great job in that one. But he's got to really settle this war. And you know, they have long lines waiting for gasoline in Russia right now, right? They have long lines. Who thought that was going to happen? And all of a sudden, his economy is going to collapse.
You know, no positive thing in his comments. Russia, his economy is collapsing. Russia has lost 1.5 million, you know, soldiers. You know, it's just, you know, he's not talking about wounded. They've lost those people who've been killed on the battlefield. He was talking about, and later on he said that. And the other thing is the way that they're trying to put pressure on India and China. And here is what he said about India.
I was not happy that India was buying oil. And he assured me today that they will not be buying oil from Russia. That's a big stop. Now I got to get China to do the same thing. I was not happy that India.
And here is Scott Bessent, the same direction. Sanctioning Russia, putting pressure on Russia.
When we can't get 7 more Democratic senators across the line, but 85 U.S. senators are willing to give President Trump the authority to put up to 500% tariffs on China for the purchase of Russian oil.
You get put all these pictures together. You don't see any reason, you don't see any movement on the part of the Trump administration to solve it politically through talks to understand what Russia is talking about. It's all about putting pressure on Russia and bringing Russia to its knees. You're taking that. What is your understanding of the moves that the Trump administration is trying to make?
Well, one thing that I know that they're trying to do is they want to introduce tariffs on whoever they can. And it's always a delicate matter because they're kind of assaulting the system of free trade, which is at the foundation of the Western system since the end of World War II, basically. They're attacking the WTO rules. And there's a lot of people who will push back against them. So if you wrap it in the, you know, in the gift wrap of, oh, we're going against Russia, we're punishing Russia, then that passes. If they say we want to introduce tariffs because we want to, do away with the WTO rules, then that gets massive political opposition. So I think that they're being opportunistic here. Now, why do they want to introduce all these tariffs? Because, you know, as Trump has said many times, he wants to reindustrialize the United States. He wants to bring manufacturing back home. He wants to develop the United States economically in a very different way from what has been practiced for the last several decades. But, you know, he has been attacked very savagely for that because, oh, he's undermining the whole global economic system and he's going to do this and that. And so if you paint it all as anti-Russia measures, then everybody cheers and accepts it. And I think this is the reason why they're doing it. I don't think they're doing it because they actually want to hurt Russia, because I don't think that's going to work to begin with. You know, it would be a little bit dumb if that was the main reason. Among other things, you know, if you got Russia and China, India and China to stop buying Russian oil, I think you'd create a panic in the oil market. You might get oil go back up to over $100 a barrel, and you'd cause... You kickstart commodity price-driven inflation, which then is again very bad for your own economy. So, as with everything, certain things that Trump does and says, or people from his administration, to me seem so dumb. I can't I can't possibly think that this is what they're actually doing, you know, because you would think like, okay, that's really dumb. So either they are really dumb or they're doing something else. Or they're doing this for other reasons that they're not telling us for some reason. And I think, you know, this is my best explanation. But again, you know, like we're guessing because obviously they're not going to tell us straight up. And we, you know, you have to kind of connect the dots to try to arrive at the best guess. And my best guess is because this is a very major policy change that Trump is driving at, reindustrializing the United States, bringing back manufacturing, creating, you know, manufacturing jobs. And to do that, you have to create a protected market. And the way you're going to protect it is through tariffs. And then if you collect enough in tariffs, you can even play with lowering taxes, which is, you know, it gives you like a little card to play for midterm elections. You can say like, oh, look, you know, we have a budget surplus now and we can lower taxes. So that, you know, that's my best guess, because if that were true, it would tell me that, you know, that they have a mission, they have some kind of a strategy, and they're not stupid. If they're doing it because they're really stupid, then we're all in trouble.
Actually, when I see Pete Hegseth talking about, you know, sending weapons to Europe, and that's a peace through strength, and you know,
yeah, that's
you really think that Pete Hegseth is smart? Is, you know, I don't see this guy being smart. He seems to me that he's, you know, he's still working for Fox News. He's not the Secretary of, you know, Defense, the Secretary of War. Sorry for.
Well, okay. So let me put it this way. I think that Pete Hegseth is smart, but he's not necessarily like a very sophisticated, you know, like he's not Douglas McGregor. He's not a Jeffrey Sachs or Larry Wilkerson. He's the guy who's smart, but maybe not with so much depth and big context. And I think he's doing what he's told to do. You know, he gets tasked to go and sell weapons to the Europeans, and he goes and he sells weapons to the European. And how are you going to sell them weapons? Well, are you going to tell them that your weapons are awesome? They're the best weapons that everybody's ever seen. And you guys can win. You can fight this war and you can beat the Russians. So just buy our weapons and then you can beat the Russians. And it doesn't matter because really, you know, it's not just about the weapons. You have to have people who are going to use it, who are going to be trained to use them. You need the logistics, you need the intelligence, you need the satellite information. You need so many, so they can, you know, they can always sell them the weapons. And then I do believe that Trump doesn't want to go to war against Russia, and he doesn't want to escalate it to the point where they would be drawn automatically because they are now a participant, you know, like if Tomahawks start flying at Russia. So I think that they're going to stop before crossing that line. But up until that line, they're just being transactional. They're doing business. And then when they get to the line, then they're going to see how they're going to shaft the Europeans. Because, you know, if the Europeans believe that Trump and his team are going to be loyal to them and keep their word and honor their commitments, well, then there's... They are being naive, and I think they are actually.
Do you think that Donald Trump would care if something happens between Europe and Russia? I don't see.
In what sense? If something happens?
Yeah, well, it's something big, positive? An attack directly attacking each other, Europe and Russia. I don't see Donald Trump caring about that. Even put Donald Trump in a better position, in my opinion, in terms of selling more weapons, in terms of, you know, Europeans being more dominated by the United States and Trump's policies. And he knows that Russia would never attack the United States because of some reasons. And that's why if they something happens between Europe and Russia, put Donald Trump in a better position. And he doesn't care about Europe, Alex. To be honest, I don't see Donald Trump caring about anything happening in Europe.
Okay, so I'm not sure that this is correct, Nima, because, you know, let's look at the two at the precedents of two previous world wars. In both cases, the American people didn't want to go to war in Europe. I mean, in the run-up to World War I, 90% of Americans didn't want to have anything to do with it. And what happens is that the Europeans get themselves into trouble. So they push forward, they orchestrate the big war, and they even start taking some serious pain, right? And then they use this to put pressure on the Americans, like, oh, you can't just let us die here. You can't look at what the Russians are doing to us, or the Germans, or whoever. You have to come and help us. And they do have this common bond with Britain, you know, the language, the culture, which, you know, if things get really, really ugly, and we have to always remember that the British control the American media, the press, that the pressure to join the European war could become unbearable again. And then if that doesn't do the trick, then you can always orchestrate some kind of a sinking of the Lusitania or a Pearl Harbor or some, you know, some other kind of a false flag event, which then is going to galvanize American public opinion and then get the United States involved in a war in World War III. You know, the difference now is that the United States, First World War, Second World War, the United States was protected because it has two oceans there, right? So it's very difficult for any invading force to do any harm to them. Today, in the age of nuclear ballistic missiles, in the age of hypersonic missiles, that is no longer any kind of a security. So if the United States got involved in a war against Russia, they would find themselves also in war against China, and they no longer have that, you know, like they would become a belligerent and fully exposed to the risks of Russian hypersonic missiles or even a mutual nuclear annihilation. So in this sense, I think you can't, you know, if you cross a certain line, then you can no longer contain the damage. You can no longer predict how it's going to play out. It's easy to cross that line, but it's very difficult to then control the fallout. And so from this point of view, I think that Trump, again, we have to guess that he's aware of all this. He's giving the impression that he doesn't think that far. But I believe that he understands this, and I think that they will not cross the line, and they will not take the risk of going to war against Russia, and that they will definitely muzzle the European powers that want to trigger this war. And I have to say this: I'm only basing this on a hunch, on an idea, but I think that the American side has told the British, do not dare to stage a false flag attack. We know you're up to it. Don't do it. We know you're up to it.
You know, the danger, Alex, with this sort of attitude, if it seems you want to fight someone or many of these, you know, the two people are fighting each other most of the time, I think more than 90%, the two people didn't know beforehand. Before fighting each other, you know, it happens. It's something, it's at the moment you decide about fighting someone, you know, you're not planning for it. You're not going and studying how to fight. And this, the same happened, you know, even with the case of Russia, or you remember the conflict, the base of the conflict has started in 2014. Russia in 2022, when they decided to put troops on the ground in Ukraine, in the eastern part of Ukraine, they haven't decided, they didn't decide to, you know, to fight, to go and, you know, to fight Ukrainians. They wanted to show some sort of leverage in Ukraine. They wanted to force Ukraine into some sort of deal. You know, to the last moment, Putin himself said that. They haven't, you know, they didn't know if they want to fight or they don't want to, because this is the reality of human being, Alex. You know, that's why I think what Donald Trump is doing is, you know, somehow this war can, you know, the confrontation can happen without knowing that it's happening, you know. This is the problem. I don't see this sort of, you know, wisdom in the Trump administration to understand this escalation, selling more weapons, you know, making fun of Europeans. You know, after all, when we talk about Europe, you're talking about, you know, a huge variety of people, mindset, you know, cultural issues, you know, historical issues. You cannot bring all of these problems all together and you say, I'm dominating them, I control them. There is no control over the behavior of these people.
You're right, Nima. But there's a very serious problem in Europe. The people who are in power are desperate to escalate the conflict against Russia to World War III. Scenario. And the only problem is that they are not capable of waging that war. So their idea now is to keep Ukraine fighting as long as possible while they prepare their own nations for the war, you know, the Brits, the French, the German, the Poles, and so on. And then they're also trying to kind of leverage the Moldovans, the Romanians. They tried with Georgia. It seems that that didn't work exactly, but they will continue trying. You know, they will. They're not going to give up. And so, I asked myself, what would I do if I were in charge, if I were negotiating these things myself, I would maybe consider forcing the Europeans to make that decision sooner before they're ready. You know, almost push them to the point where you say, okay, you wanted a war, now go. Here you go. Here's your opportunity. Not give them 5 years to invest all these hundreds of billions of dollars into new weapon systems and train up tens, hundreds of thousands of troops, run propaganda campaign demonizing Russia, preparing people, you know, like Germany in the 1930s, like Ukraine after 2014, to force their hand now to say, you want war, right? You want to go to war? Well, go. Here's, we're giving you everything. We're behind you. We're not going to fight with you, but go. Because, you know, that would bring them to a breaking point, because people like Friedrich Merz and Starmer and Emmanuel Macron, Ursula von der Leyen, they would all have to stand in front of their people and explain to them that we have to go to war against Russia. And I think that that would cause all these governments to fall. So, you know, that's a possibility to simply force their hand, to force them to make a mistake before they are ready to negotiate the consequences. That may seem like 5D chess. And, you know, people always think like you're giving Trump too much credit. They're not thinking things through that far. But Trump is speaking with the Russians. I mean, Trump, you know, people on his team, they are speaking with the Russians on a very regular basis and at a few levels. You know, there's more than one delegation that are keeping regularly in contact with each other. They're keeping in touch with the Chinese. They all know where the danger is coming from. They all know who is destabilizing the world. I think that Trump wants to see the end of the European Union. I think he wants to deal with the ADF. He wants to deal with Assemblée Nationale in France. He wants to deal with Orban and Fico and these people. He doesn't want to deal with Ursula von der Leyen and with Merz and Starmer. And so increasing the heat, increasing the pressure to go into decisions that they can't really back up is the way to precipitate their decline. So I think that that's entirely possible. I wouldn't be surprised, actually. So, you know, that would then explain Pete Hegseth's otherwise inexplicable performance. You know, like if you take it at face value, you would think these people are all completely insane. They're going to plunge us into World War III. But I don't really think that this is their intention.
Alex, 2 days ago, there was an interview with the former head of national security of Iran. And in the interview, what he was revealing about the attack, the fight between the war between Iran and Israel, he said that in the final days, Iran knew that Israel is just losing. And he said that the only reason Donald Trump came in and the United States has decided to interfere was the situation with Israel. And this guy is a really serious guy. He's not talking that much. He's a military man. He's the former defense minister of Iran. And it's not that. He's not about propaganda. He made legitimate. He said, we failed here, we failed there, honestly. And I think that he was based on the intelligence they had. He was mentioning that they knew each and every missile. Where did they hit? And, you know, he knew exactly the details of those missiles. Where, you know, this, you know, he said the location they failed to, you know, to hit, the locations that they could hit. Everything, he detailed everything. But after the outcome of what he said was that Israel was losing. Do you feel, with all that said, with the new peace deal in the Middle East, many people are arguing that Israel is preparing to go ahead and to war with Iran. When I hear Iranians, when I see what is happening in the Middle East, Donald Trump talking about the Middle East, say, if Iran gets, you know, go after nuclear, we're going to hit them again, but they're not going there. And then, you know, they're far from there. Do you feel, what is your understanding of the latest events? How can we, you know, interpret the situation in the Middle East? Is the new war coming, or is we can say that the attack, the war has made some sort of deterrent for Iran?
Well, it's that would be very difficult to predict, Nima, especially because pretty much everybody knows that you cannot trust the Israelis for anything. You know, they can even put their signatures on some agreement, and then if it suits them to break it tomorrow, they will break it. Now, I think that one thing that Trump has done with this piece, and I think that was probably the most complicated part of it, was that he provided a kind of insurance policy for Netanyahu. So I think that almost an hour or two after you and I last spoke, I read the news that Yair Lapid, leader of Israeli opposition, committed that he would protect Benjamin Netanyahu if there were any votes in the Knesset against him. So, you know, that takes pressure off of Benjamin Netanyahu, because the reason why he was keeping Israel at war was because he himself was finished. If the war finished, he would, his political life would end, and he would most probably end up in prison. And so, you know, basically he's the lord of life and death in Israel and over IDF. He's in charge, literally. And so if you remove that danger from him, then he no longer has that pressure to keep Israel constantly at war. And I think this is also the reason why Trump is now pressuring Herzog, the president of Israel, to give a pardon to Benjamin Netanyahu, because then Benjamin Netanyahu is in the clear. He no longer needs war. And, you know, obviously, you know, every one of us would like to see Benjamin Netanyahu in court and in prison. But if that means that 100 Palestinians have to get killed every day, then I'd rather Benjamin Netanyahu be in the clear. And so I think that the risk of Israel starting a war against Iran again has gone down a lot. I do believe that Trump also told them, you go to war against Iran, you're on your own. I mean, he's already said this, but I think this is also part of this deal. So the illusion of, you know, the illusion of the Israelis, we're going to start the war and then the Americans will have no choice. They're going to have to come in and fight it for us. I think that fell away. I think that probably Benjamin Netanyahu's perspective has changed a lot with this peace deal. And I think that the dealing between him and Trump was, okay, you stop bombing Gaza, you stop with attacks on Iran, and I'll make sure that you're okay. And so as long as Benjamin Netanyahu is there in power, then the deal has a chance to stick. If Benjamin Netanyahu is overthrown and something bad happens to him, then who knows? You know, I don't know. It's going to be Ben-Gvir next or Smotrich. And then, you know, you're back to square one. But I think that for the time being, let's say that the detonator has been removed from this explosive mix. And, you know, this could all change tomorrow. But I think that this piece actually has a chance of being sustained.
Is the United States, Alex, with all that said, is the United States capable of making peace with Russia? Is the identity of the United States, I'm not talking about the people of the United States, there's many of politicians in the United States, I'm talking about the core, the blob, the, you know, the deep state. Are they capable of making peace with Russia?
I do believe so. I think absolutely, without a doubt. And I think that this is more likely than not. But it's again a relatively complicated thing, because there's a deeply entrenched Cold War mentality in the United States that for almost 100 years, the pervasive propaganda has been always anti-Russian and then anti-Soviet and then anti-Russian again. And this has been practically nonstop, nonstop, nonstop. And so a lot of people in American academia, in the halls of power, in the security state, the Pentagon, the CIA, and so forth, are committed cold warriors. And so they need to be purged from the system or removed from decision-making authority. And then, you know, I think that little by little, the climate can be created for that peace to happen. And I think that at the very highest level of the government, you know, between Putin and Trump, between their respective delegations, I think especially between the kind of chiefs of staff, the representatives of the US military and the Russian military, I think that they already cooperate. They're all aware that the war between the two sides should be unthinkable because they have the power to mutually annihilate each other. And, you know, maybe people in the city of London and on Wall Street think that that would be, a risk worth taking. But I think that for the people in the military, they understand that it's not. And you remember, we even had, under Biden administration, people from the Pentagon stopped the Biden administration from sharing intelligence, not sharing intelligence, but authorizing long-range strikes into Russia, because Keir Starmer flew already to Washington with a list of targets in Russia to present to Joe Biden for him to authorize strikes against these targets. And then people from the Pentagon said, this is a really bad idea. We cannot do this. We will not do this. And then Biden, who is a committed pro-Ukrainian cold warrior, even he had to say, sorry, we can't proceed on this. I think that under Trump, this is probably even a lot stronger. We know that the Trump administration has done a few very significant steps, like they have stopped sharing intelligence on their contacts with the Russians, with the British, with the Canadians, with the Australians, and with New Zealand, with the, you know, the other four of the Five Eyes. They've also removed security clearances from, was it 27 or 37 of former high-level people in the, you know, in the Pentagon and the CIA and so forth. So I think that this purge of the cold warrior types from decision-making circuitry is gradually happening, but it'll take maybe a little bit of time. But I think that peace can be had. It will be had so long as Trump and Putin are alive, you know, and you never know. If Putin drops dead tomorrow, who knows what happens? If Trump drops dead tomorrow, who knows? But I think that while the two of them are alive, I think it's more likely than not that we will have peace between Russia and the United States. And then, you know, that's not such a shocking thing, because Russia and the United States are natural allies, and they have been allies throughout throughout the whole of the 19th century, and practically since the United States became a nation, they have been on very friendly terms. They had a very close friendship and an alliance for a very long time. Not necessarily because Americans and Russians love each other that much, but because they have really natural common interests. And these interests didn't disappear because everybody has been propagandized to ignore them. They're still there.
Yeah. Here is what FSB director Alexander Bortnikov, and he said that Russia has information about sabotage preparations against the Turkish Stream gas pipeline by British and Ukrainian special services. Do they really do? If they do that, how is that going to influence the behavior of the Turkish government? Are they going to react, in your opinion, from what we've seen so far from Erdogan and his administration? Or they feel, you know, they're going to behave like the German government, or they can be compromised, you know, they can be managed?
My guess would be that they will react like the Germans, at least Erdogan and his government, because they are very much in cahoots with the British intelligence. And so if the Brit and they are covertly supportive of Ukraine, because part of the Turkish political class is very nervous about having a very, very powerful Russia dominating the Black Sea. So, you know, while they don't want to go to war against Russia, they would like to play off Russia and Ukraine so that they keep each other weak and busy between each other. But what you can't predict is how the Turkish people might react to this, you know, because Turkish people have been seeing all this happen, and they have been seeing Erdogan, you know, fulminate against Israel and then do exactly nothing at all. And you can't predict that could be the drop that overflows the glass, and then maybe Erdogan ends up thrown out of office and somebody else takes power who might be more radical, less compromised. It's hard to say, but as far as Erdogan is concerned, I think he would try to pretend like nothing happened, like the Germans. Turkish people, a different story, but not necessarily predictable.
Yeah. Alex, the case of Venezuela is coming to the, you know, there was an article in New York Times yesterday said that Trump administration authorized covert CIA action in Venezuela to overthrow Maduro in Venezuela. What is this obsession with Venezuela? You know, bombing the boats, nobody knows, you know, these are civilians, because we have Colombians coming out. These were Colombian, you know, people. And the other day we had the people, you know, other countries. I cannot remember Burkina Faso. No, it wasn't Burkina Faso. It was the Trinidad and Tobago. And they came out and said that the United States killed some of their people because of these actions. Well, what is the obsession with Venezuela? Is that all about oil? Is that all about, you know, the mindset of putting more pressure on Russia, controlling the oil industry, the oil, you know, the market of oil?
No. It's not all about oil. There's also gold. There's other resources, but it's definitely to do with Venezuela's resources, oil primarily. But there's more than that. You know, I think that first of all, we have to understand where the pressure is coming from. Where is the pressure to overthrow Maduro government coming from? And it's not from Trump administration, and it's not exclusively from the United States. It's coming from Wall Street, but it's coming also from other banking centers, primarily the City of London. And okay, so in 2003, I think, early 2000s, Aaron Russo, he was a filmmaker. He gave an interview in which he said something very interesting and indicative. And so he became friends with Neil Rockefeller, one of the scions of the Rockefeller family, and they became personal friends. And he said in this interview how Neil Rockefeller told him that there was going to be an event. And he was talking about 9/11 terrorist attacks. And their conversation was before 9/11. But Neil Rockefeller knew that 9/11 was going to happen. And then he said, like, and then on the back of that event, we're going to declare war on terror. And that's really cool, because there isn't really a real enemy. So you can go intervene wherever and then anywhere and everywhere, because, you know, you just have to say there's terrorists there and you go to war. So we're going to go to Afghanistan and Iraq. But he also said, we're going to go to Venezuela. Okay. So the plans to take over Venezuela are not new. They're, you know, at least 20 years old and older. And then, you know, in 2003, there was an attempt to overthrow Hugo Chavez, but that that coup failed and Hugo Chavez remained in power. He was rescued by his own people and his military. And then there was another coup attempt in 2019 under Trump. And in this case, Juan Guaido declared himself president, and everybody, you know, in Europe, in London, Donald Trump, everybody said, "Oh yeah, Juan Guaido is the legitimate president." But then nothing happened. It all kind of got forgotten, and then Maduro is still in power since then. And you know, another way we know that the pressure is coming from a higher level than the U.S. government is because the leader of Venezuelan opposition just won the Nobel Peace Prize, Maria Machado, right? Yes. Maria Machado is about the last person on this planet who deserves a Nobel Peace Prize, but she got it because there's a plan at some very high level to overthrow the Venezuelan government and to instill her. Trump wanted the Peace Prize for himself, but this tells you that it's not Trump's decision, it's somebody else's decision. And now, you know, you have U.S. troops provoking Venezuela into retaliating, which then would probably give the American side a justification to intervene. But I have to ask myself, what can you achieve with 8 frigates and destroyers and 6,000 troops? You can launch some missiles, you can blow up a few things, but you can't take control of the country. I'm not certain. Let's say that the Venezuelan situation will give us maybe the most important indication of Trump, of who he is and where his loyalties lie. Because, as I said, I think it's pretty clear that the pressure to overthrow Venezuelan government comes from the banking cartel. And if Trump allows himself to deploy American military, American troops, put them at risk, to hand a victory to the banking cartel, to the global banking cartel, then Trump has betrayed his voters, he's betrayed everybody. If, on the other hand, he does like in 2019, does a lot of noise, a lot of these blows up boats, has CIA people running, I don't know what, in Venezuela, and then achieves nothing, in that case, maybe he's doing the right thing. That is, you know, like in 2019, he made all the right noises. He said like, "Oh, I recognize Juan Guaido and, you know, Venezuela, this and that," you know. It all sounded very real, except that then he turned the whole assignment to John Bolton and Elliot Abrams, two of the biggest losers in the American political class that you could possibly find. So obviously they failed at this and there was no regime change. Now, in the end, I have to explain why the bankers want a new government in Venezuela, because Venezuela has an estimated 300 billion barrels of crude oil, or maybe a little bit more than that. They have an estimated 180, 185 tons of gold reserves. And all this, you know, all these resources, you could buy them. You know, you don't have to go to war to take them. You can buy them. And the United States is by far the biggest market in the hemisphere. And so the Americans could go to Venezuela and negotiate very favorable long-term contracts to make sure that all that wealth, all those resources flow to the American markets, to the mutual benefit of both the United States and Venezuela, paid for in U.S. dollars, so that those dollars are recycled in the Federal Reserve in the United States, go to U.S. treasuries and so forth. So it could be very good for both sides. But the banking cartel gets nothing, or, you know, very close to nothing. The banking cartel wins a big win if they get control over all that resource wealth and they turn it into their own collateral, because then they can issue loans to their clients, like BP, like Exxon, like Royal Dutch Shell, and so forth. And those loans then become profitable assets on their balance sheets. And they can issue those loans because they would be secured with Venezuelan resources, Venezuelan oil or gold or whatever. And even the Venezuelan government could become the client of JP Morgan and Citigroup and so forth. And again, those loans to Venezuelan government would be secured by Venezuelan resources. How much money is that? Just to give you a perspective, because back in April, I wrote an article detailing all this with respect to Alberta's crude oil reserves, so Canada. Alberta has an estimated 175 billion barrels in proven oil reserves. In the early 2000s, or even in the late 1990s, the Rockefeller interests in New York were able to take control of that collateral. That turned it into $9 trillion worth of assets for the banking system. And most of that was used to create a new credit cycle. And the bulk of that went into mortgage, it blew up the credit bubble, the mortgages bubble, right? It was a $5 trillion bubble, which then burst in 2007, 2008. And then the banks turned around, and when the bubble burst, they went to the state to ask for a bailout. And according to the government accounting office, they received at the very minimum $16 trillion in bailouts. And it wasn't just American banks. You know, this is the thing. It's not just American banks. The bailout went to Japanese banks, to French banks, to German banks, to Swiss banks. It was basically a massive looting operation, but that looting operation needed fresh money, good collateral in the system. Anyway, $16 trillion, just to give people perspective, because, you know, trillion, quadrillion, you know, people get lost in these zeros. Basically, what it is at the very least $42,000 per every man, woman, and child living in the United States. That is far, far more than the big oil, than even the military industrial complex. Everything else, it eclipses everything else. It's the biggest prize if you take some country's collateral under your control. It's absolutely gargantuan. And so, you know, if 175 billion barrels of Canadian oil could be turned into $9 trillion of collateral into a $16+ trillion bailout, then imagine what you could do with 300 billion barrels of Venezuelan oil. You could do that same thing, only a lot bigger still. And basically, why am I pointing finger to the banks? Because they are the only group in society who have that incentive. No other group has that incentive. So they have the incentive, the means, and the opportunity. And this is where the pressure on Venezuela is coming from. And so if Trump hands them Venezuela, then he has betrayed everything that he claims to stand for. So to me, that's the one to watch. You know, things going on in the Middle East, I think I see a possibility of Trump playing a positive role. Ukraine, Russia, positive role. Venezuela is the one that worries me a lot, because there, I'm not sure that he's I'm not sure that he's on our side there. But, you know, we will know if the regime change operation fails. If it succeeds and the Nobel laureate Machado becomes the new president of Venezuela, then he handed a massive win to the bankers.
Yeah. I believe that Venezuela is so much important. And I don't know what is the policy of Russia, China, and Iran, but I really want them to support Venezuela.
Yeah, it's, you know, there's a lot we don't know. It's very complicated. Venezuela has been under very, very tough sanctions by the Trump regime, and they practically broke diplomatic relations. And then when the war started in Ukraine, then the Biden sent a delegation to Venezuela, and they had very extensive negotiations, and they came to agreements that are not fully disclosed to the public. So ostensibly, it was about sending oil to the United States. So they kind of lifted sanctions to make it possible for Venezuela to sell their oil to the United States. Okay, that seems legit and fair. But there were other parts of the agreements that were not disclosed. And I suspect that part of it was because, you know, one part of the Biden administration's agenda was to draw all these illegal immigrants into the United States. And it seems to me that they went to the Maduro government and said, like, could you maybe send us your empty out your prison and send these people our way, you know, send them to the United States. And that the Maduro government said, like, all right, fine, that's what you want, that's what you get. And that they actually then really emptied out their prisons and all these drug gangs and were really sent over to the United States. So that adds another dimension where the Trump administration has a huge problem with the Maduro government. But then Maduro government, you know, they sent secretly a delegation to talk to Trump people, and they said, like, hey, look, we stop all this. We're going to sell all the oil to you. We're going to give you preferential treatment. We're going to stop sending oil to China. We're going to cut our ties with Venezuela and with China. And you can have absolute priority in developing all of Venezuela's resources. Apparently, the answer was no. Apparently, they told them no deal. We're driving for regime change. So the situation is a bit more complicated than we know, but we know that it is complicated. And what's going to happen, I'm not sure. But again, you know, it's Wall Street and the City of London that's in the driver's seat here. And if Trump makes himself their minion, then that's going to be a profound disappointment.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Alex, for being with us today.
Always a pleasure, Lima. Take care, and until the next time.
See you soon. Bye-bye. Bye.